This episode is brought to you by the Marine Corps Association and Modern Day Marine. Exciting news, Scuttlebutt fans! Modern Day Marine, co-hosted by the Marine Corps Association and the Marine Corps League, is set to take place at the Walter E. Washington Convention Center from April 30th to May 2nd. Dive into the latest innovations, hear from senior leaders across the Department of Defense, and connect with fellow Marines and defense industry partners. Registration is now open. Visit MarineMilitaryExpos.com for more details. That's MarineMilitaryExpos.com. Don't miss this opportunity to engage in the emerging Marine Corps advancements. Hey, Scuttlebutt listeners, thank you so much for joining us and your continued support. Obviously, we can't do this without you guys, so thank you for tuning in. I am Vic. I'm here with Nancy.
Hi, everyone.
And we're super honored to have with us the Executive Director of the American Legion's Government Affairs Department, Shanin Nuntavong. Sir, thank you so much for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me here.
This is really interesting. It sort of falls in line with some of the other conversations we had. We mentioned in the pre-show that Liz Hartman from Post 539 down in North Carolina has been on the show. And you have been up on the Hill fairly recently. Obviously, as a Marine Corps adjacent organization, the Marine Corps Association, veteran affairs, veteran well-being, the lifelong commitment that we as Americans have to our service members is extremely important. So having you come in and talk to us a little bit about what you guys do at the American Legion at the 35,000-foot level, you know, talk to Liz about what a post does. But now we get to see the big picture of what American Legion does. And then with you having recently been up on the Hill, this is it's a real treat for us. So thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here today. I think what we do in our DC office is something that a lot of Marines, a lot of service members don't recognize.
And for sure.
I'd love to talk about that.
Yeah, no, this is so good. And we joked around previously, too, that like getting sort of more visibility on what it is the American Legion does, not just for the individual service member and veteran, which is obviously extremely important from the local community standpoint, but what you guys do at the larger level, at the national level, I think is so important for us to understand, because especially coming into this, a lot of times you just associate American Legion with old dudes wearing funny hats, walking in parades, right? And then that's like, oh, that's the American Legion. There's a baseball league that's named, you know, sort of named.
Don't forget this. About the cheap beer.
Oh, cheap beer, well, that, yeah. We definitely need to sit in that space for a little bit. But yeah, very important aspects. Before we jump into your roles and duties with the American Legion, let's talk a little bit about sort of your path to the Yellow Footprint. So obviously, if they had them anymore, open a phone book, you wouldn't see a lot of Shanin. And for our younger listeners
don't know what that is.
Was a thing, this large, really thinly papered document that would literally have everybody's name and phone number in them, and also some business advertisements. You would get that like once a year.
Blast from the past.
Yeah. So that I aged myself there. But if you were to look in a phone book, you were not going to see a lot of Shanin Nuntavongs listed there. So could you tell us a little bit about your background, where you're from, and how you came to be a Marine?
Yeah. I love this story. My parents immigrated to the United States, to the San Francisco Bay Area, really, from Thailand. And my mom came over on a student visa, and my dad came over on a work visa.
Oh, interesting.
Wow.
Yeah. And they didn't know each other, but they had mutual friends.
Oh, interesting.
And they met in the Bay Area and fell in love.
What a great story.
Yeah, so cool.
A couple years later, I popped out, and my sister popped out.
I'm sure it was just that simple, too.
Right.
Just popped right
how,
out.
That's how I tell my kids things happen, yeah.
So, I don't want to get into the details of that.
Yeah, let's not.
Right. Okay.
But you're right. There weren't many people who look like me, and coming from a first generation family, you know, first generation born in the United States, I was the oldest. And in Asian culture, that carries a lot of weight, right? You mm-hmm. have to be the example. You have yeah. to do things. But I couldn't find my identity growing up because I didn't know what it was. My parents were from Thailand, and I'm in America. They don't really, they're trying to understand American culture as well. And so I think I was a little lost. And I was always the smallest kid, right? The smallest kid growing up.
Yeah, yeah.
The kid that looked different.
Yeah, I always joke with my family, is like, I was a smelly kid food. That's right. I mean, I was a smelly food kid. You know, at the yep. you know, when you would bring your lunch in.
Yeah, I would
it's
always
a different thing.
Trade
yeah.
my lunch with other kids
yeah,
because
yeah.
I wanted a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and
yeah.
I didn't get that.
Yeah.
And so it was always a struggle trying to find an identity. And really, you know, I didn't do well in high school because I was still searching. I would be the kid who was friends with all the different groups, right? The popular kids,
right.
the jocks. Mm-hmm. And so being studious wasn't my thing. I barely graduated high school. I would spend my time latchkey kid.
Yep, yep.
You know.
Same.
Running around doing bad things until my junior year. Tried to follow my friend's footsteps. He joined the Navy. He was 2 or 3 years older. And that's all I wanted. I wanted to get away from being the firstborn child in the United States and wanted to figure it out on my own. So I, junior year, walked into the recruiting station after school, went down to the Navy office, closed. Air Force office closed. Of course, we've heard the story a million
yes.
times,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yes.
No kidding. The Marine recruiter there was in his dress blues for some reason and was like, come on in. I didn't know what a Marine was. These aren't conversations that first-generation families have at the dinner table
sure.
about things. And he's like, I was like, what is a Marine? He's like, well, we do the same thing the Navy does.
Yeah, like that line from A Few Good Men, right?
Yeah.
Like, hey, every time we go to war, right. you boys are nice enough to give us a ride.
That's right. I was like, all I want to do is get out and figure it out on my own and get paid for it. Can you do that? And he's like, absolutely. And that
just
was it.
Reel you in.
That's it. Yeah.
Well, as a first generation American, did you find that your role in your family was in some ways to bridge the gap between the two cultures?
I never thought of it like that. Not at all. You know, I was worried about myself. Being the smallest kid, I felt like I was always had to be extra aggressive,
mm-hmm.
extra outgoing.
Mm-hmm.
In the Marine Corps as well, I was always, I don't look like a typical Marine either. Always on the little end, you know, getting dragged along. And that spoke a lot about my career as
yeah.
well.
So, just really quick for those, the little end is an actual term, not just talking about necessarily his stature, but so when you're in a forced march, in order to keep everything tight, you have to go. You do it by height, oftentimes because the gait, the stride of the larger the taller guys obviously is going to, if you put the little end in the back, they're gonna get. Your dispersion is going to get too much, and then you're gonna end up with this accordion effect during the entire march. And so the little end was always in the front, the shorter guys, and so then the dudes with longer strides can more easily keep up and stuff. So that's an actual term they talk about, like, hey, little end, you know, pick
got
up the
it.
Pace.
I did not know
yeah.
that.
Yeah,
the accordion thing happens regardless.
It does. It's inevitable. Yeah, but
I would definitely would be at the front of any line for any listeners. Just get that picture
yeah,
as
yeah.
on the very short end of the spectrum. So go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think I wish I took a bigger role in understanding my parents' culture. I just refused to accept it because I tried to become an American. Mm-hmm. That was my sole purpose. I just didn't know.
Yeah, I think that's
Please.
I think that's a not an unusual story mm-hmm. for first generation Americans, and I think we've seen those themes in movies and literature before. So I think that's pretty typical.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic. I'll also attest that being in the Marine Corps, it allows you to have that culture absent of what society is telling you and then what your family, you know, heritage is telling you.
That's right.
And it really allows you to form that identity on your own, which is, you know, it sounds like you were looking for. But I echo a lot of that. And I think it's and I hope this resonates with our listeners, because, you know, whereas when we came in, it wasn't, at least the outward facing Marine Corps wasn't quite as diverse as it is now. I see, thinking about, you know, coming through the gate this morning, it's like you get the full rainbow effect, right. You know, at each of the, you know, the PMO Marines as they're checking your IDs, which is so fantastic. Because, you know, when I was in the fleet, as you probably remember, your caps, faps, haps, daps, all of your personnel taxes that you have to give to the base. And generally speaking, it was your dudes that you didn't want to have training. They're going out of the Marine Corps for one or two reasons, right? It's usually a bad one. And so they're like, hey, give this guy up as our, you know, base tax over. And so you always have sort of the same look coming through the gate, you know, in the 90s and the early aughts. And now, my gosh, I mean, it's so great to see how, such a buzzword, but how inclusive the Marine Corps is culturally now. It really isn't. Anyways, it's a really long way of saying that, like, it's a shame when we were growing up that this idea that I was born in America wasn't enough of an identity factor for me to feel American.
Right.
And hopefully, at least by the look of the Marine Corps that I've seen here at Marine Corps Base Quantico, I think some of that is going away.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think we're a more professional force than we were in the, you know, 90s and the mm-hmm. 2000s. I think we look different. We want to be professional. You know, those guys that aren't doing well, they're find other things to do.
Yeah.
Well, and I always like to find out, what was the reaction from your family? Yeah. There's a story there. I can see this.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a typical story, but my recruiter walked in to talk to my parents about joining, because I was on the delayed entry program. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was the end of the Gulf War, and my mom started crying, and she's like, I don't want my son to go to war. So he's like, yeah, we'll give him a desk job. So I signed up as an admin clerk. And, you know, my parents didn't understand the fact that I could still deploy and mm-hmm. still go. But it was the tail end of the war. I think right after I enlisted, they stopped giving out the National Defense Service ribbon.
You know,
for that brief period of time.
Yeah.
Because hostilities were over. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that was it. And then after I stepped off the Yellowfoot Prince and graduated, my parents have never been so proud of me.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
I love that. That's such an echo for so many.
Yeah.
We've had guests in here that have echoed that. I was the same. You know, when I joke, because I was in college, you know, I was an adult. I didn't ask my mom. I just did it.
Yeah.
You know, she's like, what did you do? but then, you know, at my commissioning, like, yeah. And of course, my uncles, you know, all of them had served in the South Vietnamese Army. They're all like, hell yeah, you know. all of my aunts and my mom were just like, what? My boy's going to die, you know, or whatever. But yeah, at the commissioning ceremony, they're like, all right, this is pretty sweet.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a very eye-opening moment.
And that was you ended up down at San Diego, MCRD San Diego.
I did, yeah.
So was Family Day your family's first time really exposed to, like?
It really was, and you know, all my life, you know, my parents were hard on me, like, you're not good enough, you're not good enough. Not that it wasn't bad, but they were trying to encourage me to be better.
Right. Mm-hmm.
This was a flip. They're like, I'm so proud of you. I've never heard that type of praise from my family until after that happened.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
What did that feel like?
Pretty amazing. I didn't want to let them down. You know, at that point, I knew that this was something special.
Mm-hmm. So good.
Yeah.
And so do you think the Marine Corps helped you find your own way?
I had to grow up in the Marine Corps, right?
Amen to that.
And this is where the stories get good.
So I was a typical guy. I worked in a Harrier squadron, so it was very intimate. A couple hundred guys together.
At Miramar?
At Yuma.
Oh, Yuma. Okay.
At Yuma. VMA 214, the Black Chief.
Yeah.
Harrier squadron. And you get to know, you know, your people. And I think I grew up a lot there, just through that exposure, deployment and trips and things like that, and those people. Got married when I was during my first enlistment. Had a baby, got divorced. That typical story.
Right.
But yeah, I think after that is when I really found purpose. I lat moved into public affairs, and I was like, this is it. I can see where I can provide value, and there's a career here for me.
That's incredible, and that's such a great thing. It might have taken you so much longer to come to that had you not been a Marine.
That's right.
Just out there in the world trying to figure it out.
Oh, I tell you, I would have been in jail or, you know, working at, you know, the local Taco Bell. We have a Taco Bell on the beach that serves alcohol.
Oh,
in my city.
Where can I get the? Let me get a 10-digit grid on that. Are you kidding me? Taco Bell that serves alcohol on the beach?
Yeah,
I mean,
it's like a cantina,
like heaven on earth. Like really, where the two places? Yeah,
that's where we should have recorded this episode.
Yeah,
I'm
honestly
thinking. Do we have a travel budget?
Oh man, we will now. So you lat move over to PAO, and for those who aren't, again, aware of the full sort of breadth of what the Public Affairs Office does, you're a combat correspondent.
Correct.
Within there. You're not, you know, I think a lot of folks, when they hear PAO, it's just like the person that's following the general going, hey, sir, you can't say that. You know, like, so you're actually a combat correspondent. Yeah.
I was, yeah. So I started off writing articles and taking pictures like every other correspondent. But I think there was this drive in me. I had a great mentor. He was an officer. I think he was a lieutenant or a captain at that time. But Danny Chung grabbed me when I was younger. And he's like, hey, you have potential to do more and do bigger and better things. And I believe he put me in positions. I didn't write stories and take pictures for very long. I was elevated to an editor or, you know, a bureau chief or those types of things because he believed in me and he saw more. He's like, you should apply for an officer program. You have this thing in you that you can do more. And I didn't see it in myself, right? I didn't see those things. So I did do combat correspondent work, but again, elevated quickly and learned what the officer did. And I think this is where we kind of changed the Marine Corps, is when the enlisted folks started doing the work of the officers,
right?
Mm-hmm. Right? During times of conflict, we stepped up and we started doing the budget and keeping the CMR and doing all these things that officers only used to do.
Yeah.
And we shown that we could do it without a degree.
Yeah.
And now, nowadays, today's Marine Corps, they're like, how do we get back to where we were? And I don't think there's ever going to go back. I know we're sidetracked here. But
no, but this is so good. This is,
and
I
why
love
does it need to go back?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But I, you know, I think we need to find our identity again as a Marine Corps because, you know, we saw that enlisted Marines can do just as well as officers.
Well, I think there is that cultural shift because, I mean, you'll hear when one of the big things, obviously, the previous commandant released an entire publication dove microscopically into talent management. I think that's why is that coming out of the long war, we're seeing that, like, if you let these kids and young adults do the thing that we advertise that they can do, and then they do it and then exceed our expectations, why would we then go back to an old paradigm that doesn't necessarily fit with the current, I mean, just the world the way it is? I mean, the world is different than it was in 2000, you know, in August of 2001.
It's a little bit like a similar situation in the post-World War II era, yeah, when so many women who had been,
there you go,
stay at home, mm-hmm, you know, because that's what you did. And then they were forced to go out and work because somebody had to, you know, the bombs, tighten those rivets, yeah, right?
Yeah. Was it Rosie Rivet?
Rosie the Riveter. Yeah. So, I mean, a kind of a similar comparison, and there are always growing pains with those types of changes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's where the Marine Corps is at now, today, right? Like, how do we evolve with what we built, what came to be?
And how do we retain? Sergeant Major Black talked a lot when he was Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps about this idea that we used to do the, you know, recruit, train, sort of release or replace. And now we're really looking at recruit, train, retain,
right?
Because we're losing so much of that. We don't want to lose all that resident knowledge. Like you said, you have this young American, this young person that has grown, stepped up, is exceeding expectations. Then you're just going to say goodbye because they want to stay another 2 years to whatever, or go to school. Like, oh, you want to go to school? See you later, traitor, you know, or whatever, you know, the things that we would say about people that are like, oh, you're in a homestead. Yeah, of course, it's Miramar. No, like, there's a lot to be said for allowing people to grow and to continue to grow. Like, the whole idea that, like, oh, we'll grow where you're planted. It's like, well, of course. But does it have to always suck?
Well, and also now there are more two-career households.
Sure.
So in order to retain, sometimes you've got to consider the other person in the relationship,
yeah,
in the household.
And the return on investment.
Yeah.
Like, someone who goes to school will probably come back because they really enjoy it and they're really thankful for the opportunity. And guess what you get?
Yeah, you get a better individual, yeah, right? Better team, smarter individual. Yeah, absolutely.
And so at what point did you begin to, or have you yet realized your own self-worth and your own, you know, skill and ability?
I don't know. I think I hear from my wife. I think she's my biggest supporter, right?
That's awesome.
Yeah. She always encourages me and do that. I always know I can do better. And I want to be better, not just for me, for my employees, for my family.
And for all the people you represent now with the American Legion.
Sure.
Yeah, it's an honor to represent them.
That's a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, as we're talking, you know, Marine Corps leadership and things, I mean, you were there. You were the advisor to three sergeants major, right, of the Marine Corps?
That's right. I started off at Headquarters Marine Corps doing media relations, and Sergeant Major Kent grabbed me and was like, hey, I want you to be part of Team 16, you know, and help shape some public affairs stuff for me. And when he transitioned out, he told Sergeant Major Barrett, hey, this is a guy you want to keep on staff. And as Sergeant Major Barrett left, he told Sergeant Major Green, hey, you need this guy to help you set up because he knows what's going on. So I was, at the tip of the spear with those three amazing individuals and learned a lot about leadership. Learned a lot about how the Marine Corps works, and it was probably one of the most amazing experiences in my career. I didn't get to deploy as much as my peers, but you can't take away being at headquarters Marine Corps at the senior level.
Yeah, I mean, you're rubbing elbows with the folks that you're with. I mean, these are sort of generational leaders.
I don't know if I was rubbing elbows, but I was a fly on the wall
for sure.
Any memories or experiences that stand out for you during those years?
Yeah. You know, I was purview to some closed-door conversations with the commandant and got to see the decision-making process in action. That was very special for me to see.
What an opportunity.
Yeah, not a lot of people get that.
Yeah. And then I've had some amazing experiences. Sergeant Major Barrett did a trip to Camp David. He used to work up at Camp David when he was a gunny. He was a company gunny out at Camp David. So
I didn't know that.
When he was Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps, HMX-1 picked us up on the Pentagon flight pad.
No way.
And flew us to Camp David. And what an amazing.
Wow.
That what an amazing time. You know, so I got to experience a lot of things.
Well, I mean, and then you were there, you fly on the wall, as you phrased it. I mean, during some, like, hardcore decision-making. This wasn't, I don't want to say, like, I don't want to minimize the peacetime eras of the Marine Corps, but, I mean, it was a gnarly time for you to be at headquarters Marine Corps.
It was. We were always fighting for the budget, you know, and
well, we had so many Marines actually fighting, right?
Yeah, well, I don't want to talk about some of the bad stuff that I did have some public affairs stuff that we had to do. That was when the scout sniper controversy was going on, and Sergeant Major being a scout sniper himself, you know, touring around the Marine Corps and doing that stuff. And, you know, Sergeant Majors will be Sergeant's Majors. And, you know, one time Sergeant Major testified and he said, Marines will always do more with less. And people took that as Sergeant Major Barrett doesn't support getting pay increases for folks, which is obviously...
Right. Yeah, that's not what he meant.
Yes. That's not what he meant. So I had to do some firefighting as well, you know, put out some fires.
So you probably learned just as much from the bad experiences as you did from the good ones.
I did. But being able to help and think through, help Sergeant Major think through some ideas, right? When you're up there as a senior enlisted guy by yourself, you have to trust on your team to help level set you.
That was a lonely island, right?
That is right. Yeah. So he would come out and I'd be like, is the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps really asking me my opinion on something?
Wow.
And I love Sergeant Major Barrett. He, to this day, if I pick up the phone and call him, he will answer.
That's so cool.
And I've learned so much about leadership and being there for your people. And I attribute it all to him.
And it sounds like those are the kinds of things that set you up perfectly for what you do now.
Yeah, I was going to thank you so much for that, because I was thinking this whole time that, like, you had so many people advocate for you. And the story that you have in your career, is it's so heartwarming because you have these leaders that say, look, I see more in you than you are seeing in yourself. And so I just wonder, like, having so many folks advocating for you, is that sort of something that you have taken now into your current position? Like, because it seems like advocating has been a sort of a mainstay in your, you know, definitely a reoccurring thread throughout your story.
Yeah, I honestly never thought about it like that. We were talking earlier about being at the right place at the right time, mm-hmm. and that right. things happen for a reason. And I think that is very true. So, long story. Sergeant Major, I was going to retire after Sergeant Major Green took over. I was going to put in my papers. I was a Geo Bachelor for most of those years because of the workload. Mm-hmm. Being on Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps team is a lot of travel and a lot of time. So we bought some property. I was going to retire. And Sergeant Major Green looked at me and he's like, you know what? The Marine Corps is not ready to let you go yet.
Oh, wow.
So he's like, what can I do to help you stay for a little bit longer. And I said, well, you can send me back to California. I'd like to, you know, get ready for retirement.
Yeah.
So he sent me out to OneMef, and there I worked for General Burger and Sir Major Kessel at MEF headquarters, yeah. Right? Trend. There's a recurring theme there. And Sir Major Black was out there as well at MLG, right?
Yeah, so that's old Cam Delmar. Yeah, that's God's country.
yeah, and we did that for 2 more years. So I did 22 years, and I was like, what do I do now? Right? Again, sense of purpose. Like, what I have to feel like I'm doing something. So former PAO of mine, Joe Plensler, retired as a lieutenant colonel on the public affairs field, saw that I was looking for a job, and he's like, hey, why don't you come work with me here at the Legion in D.C. and do some media relations stuff? Like, we'd make a good team. We used to work together several times in Okinawa and then up in the Pentagon. He worked for the Commandant, and I worked for the Sergeant Major.
Oh, cool.
So both PAOs doing stuff. And so I was like, yeah, absolutely. The reason is because in California, everyone wanted me to start at the entry level. Right? And we all feel like we're worth more.
Sure.
All of us. And so I wasn't ready to do that. My wife was homeschooling. She's like, you have to meet a certain threshold so I can continue to to teach my kids at home. So we moved back to D.C., and I started working for the Legion, and that's how it worked out. And again, people saw more in me than I saw myself. Only worked in media relations for a year. Got promoted to Director of Veterans Affairs. So at that point, I was handling policy work when it came to VA.
Wow, that's impressive. And that's a big job.
It is a big job.
Within a year. You're like, you just learned like where the head is.
Right.
And now all of a sudden you're dealing at a national policy.
And I had a staff of about 40 people working for me, doing all these things that I wasn't even really familiar with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But coming from a communications public affairs background, you're a generalist, so you can pick up things pretty quickly. And so then my boss decided to leave the organization, and they looked right at me, and they said, we want you to lead all the lobbying and policy work for the American Legion. So I did that job for 2 years, and now I've been executive director for 4 years.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and now I've got a staff of about 80, and we run. So our headquarters is split. Our headquarters is out of Indianapolis, Indiana, and that's where they do a lot of the back office stuff, right? The website, the magazine, membership, children and youth activities like Legion baseball, oratorical contests, things like that,
right.
Internal affairs membership, that type of stuff. In D.C., we're responsible for the lobbying and policy work. So we have contacts at DOD, DOL, Department of Education, and VA, and members of Congress. And that's what our job is. And so when you think about the Legion, and we talked about, you know, the smoky old bar on the corner of your town, right? 12,000 posts around the world, right? That's
international.
A lot.
That's
impressive.
Cool. Yeah. But what folks don't know is what we do in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And we lobby for their benefits. Here's a perfect example. In 2008, right, our leadership came to each individual Marine, and they're like, hey, sign up for this post-9/11 GI Bill, and you can transfer your benefits to your kids. Nobody knows how that got to be who was on the service. We were just told to do it
because
it was going to better our family. But it was organizations like the American Legion, the VFW, DAV, who lobbied Congress for that change.
That's awesome.
To better the lives.
I mean, that was a game
members.
Changer.
That's right.
It was a game changer.
That's right.
That's so great.
Now look at, you know, we're giving our kids our education benefits because I got mine while I was on active duty.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you said, you were just told.
Yeah.
Hey, knucklehead.
Yeah.
Set aside whatever it was. And you won't even see it. It'll come right out before you even get the money in your pocket.
That's right.
And to be quite honest, it wasn't a ton of money.
Right.
And it has exploded into this thing that is, I mean, it benefits the country.
That's right.
It does.
To have all of these kids getting this education.
So my team and I fight for benefits every day. I have folks going up to the Hill to talk to members and offices every day. I have folks talking to VA and DOD about how we can do things better. And that's what you get when you join the American Legion, as well as a cheap beer on the corner.
Oh, yeah,
I mean, obviously.
The fish fries and all that, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's what you get at the post level. So the American Legion's breadth is so big. We help the local community at the posts, but then you have this lobbying arm, and guess what it costs? It costs $45 a year. I mean, you spend more at dinner.
Yeah, your Netflix account is more.
That's right.
It costs more to have Netflix.
That's right. And we're helping better our benefits, right?
And making it better for the next generation of veterans, too.
That's right.
Which is really important.
That's right. If nobody is doing it, you know, who's going to care about veterans?
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I think, you know, we're using the term veteran a little colloquially. Mm-hmm. So for those who maybe don't understand the differentiation, you know, veterans obviously can still be in uniform.
Correct.
But for all service members, I guess we'll just put it that way, because mm-hmm. those in uniform are benefiting. The post of 9/11 GI Bill is a perfect example
right.
for those who are able to, where it's benefiting them before they've even left the service, before they even have their DD-214. But then for those, and we've talked to other guests about this issue, that steep drop-off, and you are up on the Hill talking this piece as well, that like the mental health crisis amongst veterans and obviously the suicide rates are just astronomical, because once you get that DD-214, there's just an absolute drop in sense of community and sense of purpose, and that leads to so many other things. So, yeah, again, what you guys are doing to bring them back, folks back into the fold, its impact to the country, I think, can't be overstated.
Yeah, and I think that sense of purpose is funny that you just said that, because I just jotted down sense of purpose. Yeah. I kind of think
you're
you
welcome.
Stole my talking
you're
point.
Welcome.
So thanks, Vic. No, but seriously, that sense of purpose, we've talked about that time and again with guests, and with Leatherneck, I've talked about that numerous times with people I've interviewed. And it's so clear to me talking to you right now that you have your sense of purpose. And do you see in the veterans, service members you meet with, the challenges of finding that once you leave your military family? And what do you think helps that? What can change that?
Yeah, I do see that. And I think great thing about I want to say I encourage everyone to join every veteran service organization you're eligible for, right? Every single one. I'm a member of VFW, DAV, MCA, Marine Corps League.
Yeah.
Because that's where my people are,
yeah.
Right? That's where we think we're going to go back home and we're going to be able to do it with the kids that we grew up in high school with,
yeah.
And back in our hometown. But you're different.
Yeah. That's so true.
I don't even want to hang out with the people I went to high school with, and I never served. So hopefully none of them are listening right now. you do grow. You grow and you change. And the people who don't grow and change are not the people you want to be around.
Right. And that's what's great about our Legion posts or any VSO post, is that you get to be with people, and that post is created based off of that community. So if you like hiking and fishing, you can find a post that's like that. If you want to be a volunteer and you want to help paint, you know, buildings, you know, for low income folks. You know, they're this is Legion posts were built for the community. So each one is going to be different. You're not going to walk into one and see one that's the same. They're all different. Just like mental health. We believe that mental health is different for everybody. And how you overcome that is going to be based on the community in which you live and thrive in. And so there should be a million different ways because we all cope in different ways. We all adjust in different ways.
And it's, you know, and as we've sort of alluded to, like, Marines are coming from all walks of life. And, you know, in certain areas, you have these vast urban, you know, megapolises, you know, where it's so easy to the sort of the daily machine just sort of grinds you down. And there are challenges there. They're going to be very different from the very rural Marine that goes back to their home. And I'm just going to take over dad's business. And then they realize, like, there are no other veterans here. And so finding those places like a American Legion post or a VFW in where you can go and they're pulling people regionally to come together and to be together. It's going to be very nuanced, right? Based off of wherever that is.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. You can't create a program for New York City that's going to work in Montana.
No, definitely not.
Yeah.
So can you talk to us a little bit about the challenges? I can't even begin to imagine what it must be like to sift through bureaucracy and red tape when you're shaping policy. What are some of your biggest challenges, and what do you like the most about doing that?
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge is money, right? We're always fighting for resources and a finite amount of money. So how do we prioritize what's important? Because everything is important, right? If everything is important, then nothing is important, right? So we have a staff, and we try to figure out what those priorities are. And, you know, I did bring my cheat sheet with me to run through some of the things,
that you may not
understand that we cover. Mental health and suicide prevention, safeguarding veterans' benefits. You see, like, the Camp Lejeune ads for, hey, did you serve in Camp Lejeune? File your lawsuit. Those people are taking money away from those victims.
It's predatory.
Right?
Yeah.
And so
claim sharks.
We do it for free. So we have an organization that will, you know, a group of folks, about 3,000 service officers around the country that will help you do your initial claim for free. If you want to file for Camp Lejeune, we have folks that will do that for you and not rip you off. So underrepresented populations, caregivers, survivors, folks with toxic exposures. Do you know, here's one thing that we're starting to fight for is, if you get out with a general under honorable conditions, you get all of VA benefits, all of them, except for one. And that's your education benefits. So you can get a home loan, you can get health care. But why won't we let you go to school and better yourself? So we're fighting for folks to get that benefit. Actually, when that bill was actually written, it says as long as you didn't have a dishonorable discharge, you should get this benefit. But somehow through the bureaucracy of fighting for things, they're like, oh, we can get less people if we only make it honorable.
Yeah.
But we've seen recently, right, with COVID and people's moral, you know, opposition to that, that they're getting out now general under honorable conditions. They can't better themselves by going to school.
And to that point, like, we've seen so many, and, you know, early into the global war, we still were trying to understand the mental health implications of our combat operations.
Yep.
And so there were a lot of Marines who their mental health challenges were manifesting themselves in some extremely negative ways. And then we were, and they were facing punitive measures, and then they were, and so we, again, to your point, like, we're just taking this damaged veteran and just like chucking them out in the street. There's that lifelong commitment we talked about, like when you first raise your right hand, like it shouldn't necessarily go away, because a lot of that behavior and a lot of that stuff that had manifested itself, it's got a deeper cause than just he's a shitbag.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And we want to make society better, right?
Yeah.
Education. Right.
Is that here? I'm going to run through a couple more of these things. Transition assistance is something that, that we're heavily working on, right? That the TAP program isn't great.
It's better, but
it is better.
There's a lot of room for improvement.
But
for
I think, in our opinion, I think if you can get a lot of that pre-work done, I went to TAP 3 times, and every time it was like, here's how you write your resume.
Yeah.
Well, give me an online module where I can do that, and instead, let's spend the hour fixing my resume.
Oh, yeah.
Making it better. Instead of teaching me how to log into eBenefits and My Healthy Vet, give me, you know, what this means instead of just signing up for things. Veterans homelessness, GI Bill parity. So do you know Title 10 and Title 32 orders are very different? Mm-hmm. When, I hate to use this, but January 6th or even September 11th, the first folks who were called up were the reservists. Mm-hmm. I was stationed in Long Island at the time at recruiting headquarters, but the folks on the ground were the reservists because there were already police officers and firefighters.
Yeah, yeah.
They were out there on September 11th. They didn't get credit for benefits because they weren't called up under the right type of orders.
Right, right, right.
Yeah, when the state calls you up to go, you know, in New York City, the subway, to go secure the subway, those are state orders. You don't get credit towards your benefits for that, right? Like, these are things that we are fighting for.
That doesn't make
sense
to me.
Well, we're seeing that now, right, with the issue with the guardsmen, right, that are getting called up and then literally deployed to border states.
That's right.
But they're not receiving the same, because it's what, Title 32 and not Title 10, right?
So it is a thing. A couple other things we're working on: military quality of life. We have a program where we visit VA medical centers. So this is separate, to get a good pulse of how things are going. That's independent good. Third party. But now we're going to bases.
Mm.
So we went to Yuma a couple months ago, and I think we're trying to get to Fort Riley, Kansas. To go visit the base and really hear from the command and from the service members and their families about what quality of life looks like over there. Mm-hmm. You know, is childcare provided adequately? Is base housing doing what they're supposed to do?
Yeah.
And we also provide the commanders with an access to be open and honest. And we can share that information with members of Congress.
Interesting. Wow. Yeah.
Right? We can be advocates.
Yeah, because you're not writing their fit rep. So, like, tell me, like, be honest.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Tell me what's really going on. We had a really good visit. And then here's a big one. Back in 2018, when we had the government shut down, members of the Coast Guard weren't paid. So the American Legion gave out over $1 million in grants to junior enlisted families, gave them $1 million so that they can live through the shutdown. And we are still to this day fighting to make sure that the Coast Guard gets paid if the government gets shut down.
Jeez.
I don't know what's crazier, that we still are talking about the possibility of government shutdowns, or that in and of itself is mind-blowing. because there are actual people with consequences, just like you're talking about.
But it's insane to think, though, that entire branch of service members.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that seems, and obviously this is World Corps Invict, this isn't a Marine Corps Association, you know, official position, but it seems criminal that that's happening, especially considering you look at the mission that the Coast, that the Coasties execute. I mean, that is a kinetic environment.
That's right.
For so many of them. And then to not get paid. And to your point, government shutdowns seem to be an almost annual evolution. You think we would have like a SOP now for how this is supposed to play out?
Well, and do the Coast Guard, members of the Coast Guard not get paid because they fall under DHS in terms of the budgeting and where money comes from? And so they're just. Yep.
Under Homeland Security, they. DOD will get
I have
funded.
A lot of thoughts about that, but I'll just keep them to myself right now.
We would do a two-parter. Yeah. We'll just have you just talk into the microphone.
About the Department of Homeland Security and the bureaucracy. I'll just be quiet. For now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, clearly your guys' role here far exceeds, you know, I guess what probably a lot of the public perception of what American Legion is doing for. And again, like, granted, this is veteran advocacy,
sure.
But I mean, this has national implications.
Absolutely.
And long-term implications.
Absolutely. We are, you know, people don't think about it, but, you know, if I didn't fight in Afghanistan, but our allies in Afghanistan who are still waiting for their citizenship, right? They fought alongside us.
Don't get me started.
Well, I have to, right? Because the world is watching us, and they're watching us in the way we treat our Afghan partners.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. 100%.
Next time we're in China or Russia, do you think do we speak Chinese or Russian? Like, how do we get help without supporting our allies who are willing to fight alongside us?
And in many ways, taking on that a risk that far exceeds. Now, granted, maybe you don't give them a weapon, you don't have them, take point on a patrol.
Sure.
But when we leave, that joker's got to stay there.
Yeah.
And face all of the reciprocity and, you know, the vengeance and everything from their actions. I mean, we could go on and on about the risks that they take and you know, having to uproot their families constantly and, you know, wearing masks while out in the public and things of that nature. Yeah, so, I mean, you're right. It's going to have national strategic effects if we don't do this right, because the next time we go and say, hey, help us out, we'll look out for you, you're like, based off of what, you know, evidence.
That's right.
That's right. That's a big order to address, and I honestly did not know that was something the American Legion focused on.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what frustration you must feel. I'm feeling frustrated just hearing about bureaucracy, because nothing drives me crazier than that concept of, you know, a bunch of over-caffeinated people who've watched too many episodes of The West Wing, and that therefore gives them the skill and ability to make these big decisions for people. So it's a good thing there are people like you advocating for veterans, service members, and those affiliated.
Yeah, it's a tall order, but I tell you what, I am so proud of my team in D.C. They fight every day to make veterans' lives better. You know what? I sleep well at night knowing that my team has done something to improve somebody's life.
Yeah.
That's great.
Whether it's filing their initial claim or if it's fighting Congress for benefits. It is
I wonder, too, awesome. Like, does that get sort of – and I'm so happy that you have that perspective, because I would imagine, at least, you know, World According to Vic, like, you're so focused on these massive national level policy things that it, when maybe you don't necessarily get the successes at that rate, you feel like, ah, we're failing. And it's so easy then to lose sight of, like, yeah, but we had that one guy that needed this one thing, and we provided that for them, or this one gal, or, you know, this person that was completely out of sorts, and we've now got them on the right path to having a better quality of life. I mean, or service member who, you know, after your guys' tour now has a better base housing situation, or the barracks now have something, you know, that they needed that they've always wanted. And it's so good.
Yeah. Yeah. Always finding.
And I know from our Leatherneck article on the American Legion, I think it was about 2 years ago, one of the things we talked about in the article, well, Sarah Bach wrote the article. She talked a lot about the shift the American Legion has to bring in younger service members and veterans. And is that something you're still pursuing, and how is that going?
Yeah, I think it's going well, right? I think when we educate the force about what we do, people realize that it doesn't cost very much. We're helping a bigger cause than myself. I think folks in the younger generation get that. They see that, right? It's not that old smoky bar. A lot of those bars are still there. They're just not smoky. And they're more family oriented, right? So you're going to get that community effort. But when I talk to active duty folks, like at Fort Belvoir right here, and I mention the things that we do on Capitol Hill, that resonates with them.
Oh, really?
That really draws in the younger crowd. They're like, I see now. Because they don't need that. Right now, they don't need that bar.
They've got their community. They've got their tribe.
That's right.
That makes sense.
They're like, well, if I can help my future or somebody else's future, that's worth $45.
Yeah.
For sure.
I think this younger generation, too, is so much more aware of the national level implications of things. I think all of them want to champion causes, like you said, that are going to have a greater impact beyond their community. Now, I would argue that that sense of community is the foundation, and you can't discount it, because that's really where change really occurs, and on a sort of tactile level.
That's right.
But yeah, and you offer both, so that's amazing.
Yeah. It you know, we just got to do. We're used to folks coming to us, and I think we're just changing the mindset. Like, how do we get to them? How do we share what we're doing? Mm-hmm. Right now, our biggest initiative is Be the One. Be the One is where we talk about it's okay to seek help. Right. A friend of mine came up with this idea. You know, 22 veterans was a big thing for a long time. Right. We now know it's less than that. It's about 18 to 17. But regardless, people are always fixated on the negative number. Mm-hmm. He's like, let's fixate on what's the most important number is one. If we can save one veteran's life, what a difference will that make?
Yeah.
Right? We all can save one just by being there, by talking to somebody, by finding the resources that they need. So be the one to make a difference in somebody's life. So we want to change that negative 22 number to one. Let's focus on one.
What a great perspective. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think that applies to a lot of things, too.
It also makes it seem less daunting, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like that old adage, like, how do you eat an elephant? You know, that's like one bite at a time, right?
That's right. Yeah, and people get it. You know, I can be just by sitting and talking, getting to know, asking questions about themselves.
Right. It's powerful. It's a powerful tool. Mm-hmm. That's great.
Well, Shannon, this has been so great having you in and taking the time on a morning, a blustery temperature abruptly changing pollen infested.
We can't let you leave. Yeah, this is my favorite thing.
This is the softball.
Yeah, this is what I sit here and wait for this. We can't let you leave without asking you, what was your best day in the Marine Corps?
I have I've thought a lot about this question, and for me, it's really, really easy. It very few occasions in life do you get a group of diverse people to come together. Weddings, funerals, and retirement ceremony. And I look back and to see all of my mentors and all of my friends, my leaders, and my family together. I retired in 17, and I've lost 4 of those people already.
Oh, wow.
Some medical and some by suicide. Mm. And so they're all there for me. Came from all around the world to celebrate me. And that's a very humbling thing.
Sure.
And to know that, you know, some of those friends and family members are no longer with us is heartbreaking. But we did get to celebrate together, and it was a joyous occasion. So probably the best day to celebrate a culmination of 22 years.
Sure.
And the beginning of the next chapter for you.
That's right. And I'm very honored and humbled to be doing this.
Awesome. That's so awesome.
Good. Yeah, that is great. Well, thank you again so much for coming in and spending some time with us. This has been really great. I've learned a ton, and it's been, your story is really fascinating. So thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for the opportunity. This is fun.
Come back.
I will.
Yeah, keep doing the good work that you do. We would like to thank the Marine Corps Association and Modern Day Marine for sponsoring this episode. Attention, Scuttlebutt listeners. Prepare for an incredible experience at the Modern Day Marine Expo, happening April 30th to May 2nd at the Walter E. Washington Convention Center. Dive deep into military advancements and networking. Plus, the Objective One Wargaming Convention is back for its 2nd year. Expect nothing short of awesomeness, so bring your A-game. Don't miss out. Secure your spot now. Also, Nancy, William, and I will be on site recording episodes live from the showroom floor. Come by and say hi. Visit MarineMilitaryExpos.com for more details and to register. That's MarineMilitaryExpos.com. Hope to see you there. Scuttlebutt is a production of the Marine Corps Association. You have heard the voices or contributions from Major Vic Rubel, USMC retired, Nancy Lichman, and or William Truding, and Shannon Nantavong. Ty Frazier is the editor, sound engineer, and technical producer. The Marine Corps Association is not an agency of the U.S. government. The opinions expressed in this episode are the personal views of the participants and do not reflect the official position of the United States Marine Corps, the Department of Defense, or the Marine Corps Association.